Pittsburgh, I love ya. This is Brian Edward, and you're listening to Berg Vivant, Pittsburgh's cultural talk magazine, delivered digitally, straight up, shaken, and stirred. Tonight's broadcast brought to you by our spectacular sponsors and strategic partners, Zafalo's Banquet and Event Center, Carnegie, Pennsylvania, one of the most beautiful and unique venues in the greater Pittsburgh area for weddings, corporate dinners, fundraisers, and more. Visit clubzafalo.com. Off the Wall Theater, enlivening, educating, and entertaining audiences in the Pittsburgh region. View their current season at insideoffthewall.com. Arcade Comedy Theater, hosting local and national comedians, sketch comedy, improv, and more. 811 Liberty Avenue, downtown. Be sure to like them on Facebook or find them at arcadecomedytheater.com. Berg Vivant is a proud supporter of Firefly Arts, creating opportunities and support for families living with autism through innovative arts programming. You can learn more and show your support at fireflyarts.org.
Jeremy Kushner, welcome to Berg Vivant. Welcome to Pittsburgh.
Thank you so much. Thank
from Canada by way of Broadway.
Yeah, it was a circuitous route, but whatever.
It often is. So you are from Canada originally.
Originally from Winnipeg, Manitoba.
What goes on up there aside from snow?
Staying warm.
Yeah?
Yeah. There's a lot of staying warm. No, we actually, Winnipeg's got a great theatrical community. It's got a great music community. The Guess Who is from Winnipeg, American Woman. Who else? Neil Young was in Winnipeg for a while. There's a lot of pretty famous people from Winnipeg.
Now, here in America, for every musical theater or aspiring musical theater star, it's you got to get to Broadway. Mm-hmm. Is it that same sentiment in Canada? Broadway's the place to be?
I think for some people it was. I got to work a lot as a really young kid. You know, Winnipeg's actually very similar to Pittsburgh. I feel very
really?
At home here. Yeah, in the way that this theater community is really strong here. It's amazing to be in this neighborhood and to see so much going on and so much support for the arts. And so I got a lot of opportunity at a really young age. So when I moved, I moved to Toronto from Winnipeg. There was more work. It was kind of like Toronto's kind of the New York of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And when I moved there, there was about five or six full-scale Broadway shows going on at the same time, so there was a lot of work. But I never really had huge aspirations to go to Broadway, which is weird, I guess.
It just happened.
I just really like working. I was talking with Tegel, who plays Othello in the show with me today, and he was sitting here watching. He went into the beginning of the show that's running right now, which is how I learned what I learned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the music started, and people the anticipation, and he just went, This is why I do this. This just feels so good. So it was never about celebrity or stardom. Although I'm not going to turn.
Well, right.
I'm not going to turn a movie contract down or a TV show down. But it was more about just this was what I was going to do. The work that I was going to do, and this is where I needed to be. So when Broadway came around, it was really sort of a more of a surprise to me than anything.
How'd you get to Broadway? I just fell into it.
Practice.
Well,
yeah.
Right.
No. Yeah, so it wasn't huge on my radar. I'll put it that way, I guess.
So I think one of the things that you're most notable for is originating the role of Ren McCormick in Footloose, the musical.
Yes.
Now, how did that come about?
It's a kind of a long story, but the short version of it is I was out of work in Toronto, and I got a call from my agent saying that if you can be in New York tomorrow, I've got an audition for you for this workshop of this new show. So I scrounged together some money, and I got it. There's a Greyhound bus that leaves Toronto at 11 o'clock at night and arrives in New York at 11 o'clock in the morning, went, had the audition, stayed over the next night, booked the show, came back, and then sort of the rest is history. But
it is.
Yeah, being on a 12-hour bus ride in the middle of summer, a Greyhound bus ride, nothing against Greyhound. But
of course. There are high schools doing that musical now.
Yeah.
It's come to that point.
Yeah, well, there are 30-year-olds that come up to me and say, that was the first show I ever saw when I was in high school.
Wow. Now, do you ever have a desire to maybe go to a high school performance of it and freak people out?
I actually went to one last year. The Catherine Cox, who played my mother in the show, she was friends with a woman that runs a school in New York, a private school in New York, and they were doing the show. And they called me up and they said, would you come and be sort of a surprise guest on opening night? I was like, sure, that sounds like fun. went and saw the show and went and got to talk to the cast afterwards, and it was amazing. And to sit with the two of us, it had been probably about 15 years since,
wow,
or 16 years since we had done the show.
You're right. I forget that.
It's 18
God, where's
now,
the time gone? And then Jersey Boys, another big credit of yours.
Jersey Boys. I did a lot of companies at Jersey Boys. Started in the Chicago company and went to the Las Vegas company and then did the tour for a little bit and then did the Toronto company and then finally made it back to Broadway and did it there for a little while. It's an incredible show. It's funny. Tommy DeVito in Jersey Boys is actually, in a lot of ways, really similar to the part that I'm playing, just without the music. But it's very sort of a little bit the bad guy, but also the whole idea of bringing the audience in, breaking that fourth wall, and making the audience an unwitting, you know, accomplice in what's going on in the show is sort of similar to what we were doing there.
Right. So you will be playing Iago in the Public's production of Othello.
So far.
No one.
My code still works at the stage door. My key still works at the housing,
well,
so I know that I'm still
doing
it.
We're going to release this interview very quickly so that it's you know, relevant and current. I think the most pressing question that I have to ask you before we proceed any further, Othello or Otello?
Othello.
Thank you.
Yes. I mean, last time I talked to him.
Yeah. But now, is it, because I know the opera is always referred to as Otello.
It's probably the...
But there's a language
probably
thing?
The Italian,
okay,
pronunciation.
But nobody refers to the title of the Shakespeare play as...
Otello?
Otello.
No.
Okay.
Maybe it's someone with a speech impediment.
Well,
maybe I'm totally wrong. I don't know.
Maybe I am, too. This is why I'm asking.
No, I mean, so far, we're calling it Othello.
All right.
So far.
Yeah, good.
Iago,
so,
Othello.
From Ren McCormick in Footloose to Jersey Boys... What do you think was the reason that Ted Pappas said, yes, my God, this is the guy that I need to play one of Shakespeare's most nefarious villains?
I don't know. I mean, I found out that Ted was doing... One of the reasons that I'm here is actually because of Tegel, who's playing Othello.
Mm-hmm.
A good friend of mine in New York taught Tegel back at NYU. His name is Joseph Saravo. And he said, Jeremy, a buddy of mine is playing Othello. I think you should go out and audition for Iago. And at this point, you know, I don't get a lot of opportunities to do Shakespeare. I don't get a lot of opportunities. As soon as somebody finds out you can do something, they sort of keep you in that box.
Mm. Now, would it be difficult if you were kept in a Shakespeare box?
I think,
would that be...
I don't know if it'd be difficult. It's an amazing... The enjoyment that I get out of doing Shakespeare is incredible. But there's a real similarity... There's a real musicality that really lends itself to doing Shakespeare. So I don't know. I just worked my ass off for this audition. I really, really decided that this was something I really wanted to do. I went and worked with my buddy, and we broke this character down and really... You know, I made this... This was something that I was going to do. So I walked into that audition with... The idea that I was gonna show Ted that there was every reason in the world why I should play this role, because on paper there isn't necessarily. Even my agents, when I first brought it to them, they were like, "You want to play Iago in Othello? Is it a musical? Is there a musical version?"
Now that would be a concept.
Yes.
Iago a go go.
There is an Othello musical out there. So there is. There was a movie.
God.
It was called. Catch My Soul, and I found it. You can find it on YouTube. There's bits of it on YouTube. And the way that I found it, there's a song that, there's this drinking, the old English drinking song that Iago sings in the show. And of course, there's no, you know, they don't give you sheet music when you get, you know, the Arden or your script. And so I was doing research on, you know, what different versions of the song might have been and what from this period, what songs would have sounded like. And so, you know, thank God for the internet. I go into Google and I put, the song is Canic and Clink, and I put Canic and Clink, and I put Othello, and I put Song, and the first thing that came up was a Jerry Lee Lewis version of this song from Othello. Jerry Lee Lewis playing Iago in Othello. And the first thing I did is I emailed it to Tegel, and the first thing he did is email me back cussing me out for putting the song in his head.
And now it'll never leave his head.
So now I'll sing it every once in a while. But yeah, it's amazing. There was a musical version.
And incidentally, that will be the curtain call music for the Public set.
I hope not.
Production
really
of Othello. But let's talk about this guy, because this is by far one of my favorite Shakespeare villains. And what has always impressed me about is the dynamics, the depth You know, it's not just a one note, I'm out for revenge. There's so much more psychology to it that it's creepy. It's almost, you know, diabolical.
Yeah.
And when you think that there was a writer grasping this, you know, what, 600-700 years ago now, it's really incredible. And I think is the reason why it stands up and why this story is still, you know, being told on stage after stage. Tell me about your approach to this guy.
Well, it's funny because, I mean, I always feel like, you know, regardless of how much of a villain you're playing, you have to approach it as a person. You got to, you know, the guy who's the villain never thinks he's the villain. This might be one of the cases that's not actually the case. I mean, I really, Iago, his darkness is something that he actually revels in. There's a lot of, I think a lot of it comes out of jealousy and you know, that's a huge theme in the piece, which is another reason why I think that the play stands up and why there's so many versions of it, you know, pop culture versions of this piece. But as far as Iago goes, yeah, he playing this just really innately sociopathic, evil...
Sociopathic is a good word for it.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of people would heartily disagree. But from an outward standpoint, I mean, the guy's one of the original sociopaths. I mean, his complete utter disregard for anyone other than himself is amazing. But he's also an artist. He really finds, Iago, really find that it's, Ted and I talked about it today a lot, there's just in the way that he's manipulates these people around him, there he really sees an art in it. He really goes like, I'm not only going to really mess these people up, but I'm going to do it better than anybody else. And I'm going to make this my pièce de résistance. This is my art. You might not understand my art, you might not get my art, but this is my art. And so that's one of the ways that I play it. And frankly, it's just fun. It's just... to be able to, like I said earlier, to turn to the audience and make them accomplices, where they have no choice. You know, now I'm going to do this to these two. Watch this. I'm going to tell him that I really like him, and then I'm going to make him want to kill his wife. Ready? Here we go. And then you do, and they go, no, stop. You know, they really, like, to get the audience to really go, no, we don't want, stop, help, help. That becomes really fun.
He's deliciously diabolical.
He really is. I mean, and the piece itself is just so perfect and so wonderful and so full of the language. The language of the piece is so amazing. I mean, of course, all of his writing, but specifically this one is really been fun to literally dig our teeth into.
Now, is there a strong concept that we can expect to see associated with this particular production? You know, sometimes, you know, seeing a show several times, you know, a director will come along and put a, you know, slightly different vision on it, or set it on the moon in the future, or something like that.
I think that Ted's concept before any of us came onto it was that we were going to this. The piece was really going to be about the words and the actors. So even the set design is really sparse. There's not huge set pieces coming in and out. There's not a lot of props. It's a really bare stage. It's a really open sort of great playable area, but it's about the words and it's about the story and it's about the actors telling that story. So that was really his concept. It was, you know, it's set at the time that it's supposed to be said. You know, we're not putting it on the moon. We're not putting it in New York. Not that any of those things are wrong, but his concept was, this is a great play, and we're going to present the play as it's written, and we're going to give the play its due reverence without putting, you know, this any kind of sheen on it. Now, not to say that this is not a big piece, because it's a bit of a monster. It's 18 actors doing a Shakespeare piece. It's a monster. There's a lot of play to get through. Ted has done an amazing job of the cut of the play. It's really cool. It's really fast moving. It's well paced, I think, for a modern audience. But it really isn't. You know, he isn't simplified it. He hasn't made it something that is going to be more palpable to people that perhaps don't hear this language every day. He's made it so that the language speaks for itself, and you get it. It's great. You know, luckily you have this great, this amazing theater that presents stuff like this. So you have an educated audience. Mm-hmm. You have an audience that isn't coming in for the first time going, what the hell are they saying? But, you know, he really did want to make a piece that, even though we are relying on the text and we're relying on what Shakespeare has given us, we're also giving, we're also warming an audience up into this language, into this text. So that's kind of a long answer, but I really do. He wants to make it look pretty on us, mm-hmm. but it's more about what it's about, making this piece come alive through the text, through the actors.
Now it sounds like you're having a great time, and it's a lot of fun. But I imagine it, you know, approaching a character like this in a work like this, it's a monumental piece of work at the same time. So if I'm likening this to maybe like figure skating, and there's that point where they get real nervous. It's got the triple Lindy whatever plex, and if they nail that, boom, they've got it. For you in this production, what is your hurdle? What is that, the greatest challenge?
Getting to the curtain call.
Yeah.
Stamina is a big one. There's a lot of words. There's just a lot of words, and you want, you know, the respect for the actual words, and then putting them all inside your body. That's a big one for me. I mean, this is the third, according to a lot of things that I've read, it's the third largest byline character that Shakespeare wrote.
Mm. He is wordy, yes.
So that's a huge thing to overcome. But once we're in it, once I'm in there with Tegel and I'm in there with Amanda and Jessica and all of these, DePaul and all these really, really great actors, it just becomes fun and it becomes really natural. It's been a really amazing experience. I mean, I have a huge respect for Ted and a huge debt of gratitude for taking whatever this chance is on me to come in and play this role. I think he bet well,
mm-hmm.
but nevertheless, you know, it's a gamble. I think any casting is a gamble in a lot of ways, but I think that a huge one for this is the fact that he really wanted to put together, we talked about this today, he really wanted to put together, it's a team, right? It's mm-hmm. you know, all of these different instruments. We talk about it musically a lot, how these people have to, all these different characters are different instruments, and it's funny because Iago plays a lot of different instruments, because every time he does a duet with somebody, every time he's on stage with somebody, he's actually wearing a different mask. He's playing a different instrument, because depending on what that person is, he's got to figure out what the exact other sound is that's mm-hmm. going to perfectly work with them. So part of that was finding a bunch of people that were going to fit into those different instruments well together, but also a bunch of people that were going to exist in the same version of this piece, you know, because he can design it and he can set up what he wants it to be, but if he doesn't get a bunch of people that are on the same page, then all of a sudden you got a big mess. Mm. So that was the other thing, getting people that were going to play the same way. And there's a certain athleticism.
I get it. Yeah,
there's a certain amount of athleticism that you have to have for this piece. It's just a monster. It's a monster. You don't leave the set. You don't leave the stage. And you know, luckily for me, from a sort of an emotional standpoint, I get to be a little bit removed emotionally mm-hmm. from the piece. I get to, you know, turn to the camera and say, blah 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 blah. You know, a guy like Tegel really has to open it up. He's got to open a vein every single night and go there. He never gets to sort of step away. So,
do you feel it's important for an actor to recharge after that emotionally?
Well, that's what we're doing now.
Yeah, and rightly so.
I mean, you can't recharge better
than with a Berg-Vivant martini at the Pittsburgh Public Theater.
Well, cheers,
indeed.
Cheers to that.
Mm-hmm. You know, Ted Pappas will not come on this show.
I've heard. He says terrible things about.
Now, to be fair, I haven't actually asked him.
Oh, well, that might be why.
So, yeah. But I mean, doesn't he just like appear like a theater genie or something? Like, I mean, really?
He is.
Yeah.
He is. Sometimes just in the middle of rehearsals.
And I heard, though, if you go into the dressing room and shut off the lights and say his name three times into the mirror, you know, poof.
Yes,
Ted Pappas, Ted Pappas, Ted. Now, I did that once and I got Joseph Papp instead.
Which is really strange.
Yeah, but I mean, it was close, so maybe I got cut off before I put the ass on
well,
the
yeah, you got, yeah, you want to make sure you put the ass
on the air. Wow. I didn't intend on going there.
No, but you did. But you did.
No, I jest, of course.
Yes. No. I believe it was a challenge. I believe he actually said, you know, he better get my the entire name on the show at some point.
Oh yeah. We said it several times today.
He definitely wants to.
So working with him's been a pleasure
beyond.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, working with this entire, you know, this.
You've got a great group.
It's a really great group.
You really do.
But from top to bottom, I mean, not just the actors. Not just the directors, the staff here has been incredible, and the theater itself is incredible. I'm really excited.
Well, I hope
really
that you'll consider working in Pittsburgh again. We would love to
after
have you.
This experience, absolutely.
Now, do you get to, I know you're very busy with the show, but have you gotten to maybe venture out much into any restaurants or take in any culture? Or
you know, we've got our, you know, sort of 5-block radius that we've, that I've allowed
before
myself.
Your ankle bracelet goes off.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, we went to the other day. We were over at Butcher in the Rye.
Oh, isn't really it like fantastic?
I like it. I enjoy a good cocktail, and they make a very good cocktail. Mm-hmm. Went down to where else have we been? Mercado.
Oh, the meatball place, which is what I always refer to it.
We've actually gone to the second floor. I've never eaten at the meatball place, but the second floor, because I also love a good charcuterie platter.
Thank you. You know, it's funny you talk about that, because the meatball place, Mercado's come up on Berg Vivant a couple times, and nobody.
You know, I'm only trying to get free stuff.
Right. Oh, yeah, and as am I, so let's make sure we say it all we can. Yes. But nobody has ever. You're the first person that I've talked to that's ever been to the second level. Everybody I talked to, including myself, have been to the first level, have been to the third level, but nobody's been on the second, nor can anybody accurately describe to me what goes on that second level.
The second level's great. Great pizza.
Yeah?
The charcuterie plate was... I will go back for that, for sure.
I love that word.
Charcuterie.
Yes.
I just keep saying it. I don't even know what it is.
I think it's like little... sliced dried meats, isn't it? Like prosciutto and pepperoni and hard salami and maybe
some little baby pickles.
Right, maybe even mustard. A little raw stuff. But I was under the impression it always referred to meat, though, and I could be wrong.
I think it mostly is meat, but I think that on those plates you can sometimes have cheese.
And so I, at home, when I'm entertaining and I just put out a couple little slices of pepperoni, I'm referring to that as charcuterie because I just like saying the word.
I think you can. I think you can.
I'm going to, even if I am grotesquely incorrect.
But I would highly suggest that the charcuterie at both places.
Mm.
Both places are amazing. I love food and I love a cocktail.
Pittsburgh's a great food city.
Yes, and I'm really excited. Problem is you know the I do tend to lock the script on my ankle so that because I will go out and have a drink. So best thing for me to do is go home and just get the words in my head at this point.
Very noble, very wise.
Yeah.
Good work ethic.
Well, let's just, now you're just.
But no, you do a lot more than this, and I think maybe a lot of folks might not know this. You have a music career. I mean, aside from musical theater.
I try to. Yeah, I write music. I have a couple of albums of my own, all stuff that I've written, which I'm really excited about. But I'm actually really excited about, there's I have a new band that I put together that, it's a bunch of actors, so you know, getting us together is like herding cats.
But a band made up of a bunch of actors.
Yeah,
like the Monkees, kind of.
Kind of like the Monkees.
Yeah,
they're actually the rest of my band is a lot like the Monkees. I'm the old guy of the band. I'm kind of the grandpa of the band. What I found was if you find a bunch of really cool 20 and 30 year olds, they'll do it for free.
Oh.
I know. That's I've been making mistakes.
I need some interns on Berg Vivant.
Yeah, that's the way to do it. That's the way to do it. No, these guys. We right now the name of the band is Canadian White Bread, and we're just in the process. We've got a bunch of songs.
What was the inspiration for that title? That band.
I opened up my fridge one day, and my brother had been shopping at Trader Joe's. It's another place that I've frequented here several times now. But my brother had been to Trader Joe's, and I opened up the door, and there in the door was this loaf of bread. And it said on the side, it said Canadian White Bread. And I called my boys in the band and I said, I found the name.
Eureka.
I found the name. This is the weirdest name for a band that I could find. I also have I've got two daughters. I've got a 5-year-old and a 4-year-old. And I asked them, I said, you guys can name the band too. And Pretty Pretty Princess didn't go over as well.
Really? Come on.
Yeah. So we had a...
That might limit your gigs, yeah.
Well, you never know. You know,
and it would open you up to others, I think.
You really, it really might. But yeah, so yeah, so I've got some new stuff. I've got all kinds of stuff on the horizon. I'm trying not to limit myself. This, Othello is a huge step in a direction that I'm really excited about.
How do you manage all this? Music, performing, family?
You do what you can.
And I imagine travel is takes up a lot of your time too.
Yeah.
But I have listened to a couple of tracks from your albums. You have two solo albums or two under your name, under your title. Pretty good stuff. I think one of the tracks was featured on One Tree Hill, is that correct?
Yes, a good friend of mine was a writer on One Tree Hill, so I was living out in Los Angeles, and he said, I can get your music to the music supervisor if you want. I was like, sure. So I called up all my friends and we watched, and we were like, oh, there, it's in the background. And it's done. Great. But yeah, it was pretty cool. It's exciting,
So where can we find it? iTunes?
You can find my stuff on iTunes. The one of the albums is called In Time. Mm-hmm. The other one is just self-titled Jeremy Kushner. But if you go to jeremykushner.com, that's my website. It'll point you in the right direction. But yeah, iTunes, you'll find me there.
Fantastic. Yeah,
if you've got Spotify, you can find me there.
Many of us do. Mm-hmm. I'm an iTunes guy.
I like iTunes myself. Too.
Click,
I like
click,
iTunes.
Boom, it's done.
Yeah.
But I still every now and then appreciate having a disc, a physical.
I've got tons of those, and they make great coasters.
I know that's what's happening to all of them now. And I've converted my whole library now to digital, so I've got a whole shelf full of coasters.
Yeah, a lot of them. Well, at least your picture isn't on all of them. So.
That could be a
range. That gets awkward.
Yeah, I suppose it does after a while, checking it out. Can we, hawk these CDs in the lobby during...
That's something we have to talk about.
Is there a tie-in there? I mean, we're saying how musical
is. It's a bit of a strange tie-in, but it's possible. Hey, it's possible. I got a box full.
I'm all about marketing and PR here.
You never know. You never know with every, maybe with every Iago Martini, you get a free Jeremy Kushner CD.
We're all looking forward to...
I'm thinking cross-marketing now.
Yeah, that's the only kind, when you're mashing two completely divergent things together.
Yes.
Cross-marketing is the only appropriate title for it. But we are all looking forward to your performance and your spin on the Shakespeare villain, Shakespeare dynamic character. Do you feel villain is appropriate for this guy? He's a little... More,
I hate to use it only because it can seem reductive, but he really is. I mean,
he owns
is,
it.
He really, and it's not. Maybe it's more reductive when
listen
some
to your fans out there, they're honking.
I know. I just am trying to be a normal person. I just want to go to the CVS and get my toilet. Just leave me alone.
At least give them the number three pose, so they're flat, but,
I think that when a character himself calls himself the devil and a villain, I think it's okay to sort of say that.
It always struck me as like the original disgruntled employee. Because isn't that part of it? He was looked over. I mean, there was the jealousy part, but he was looked over for a position.
That's what he tells us. So the other thing that I've realized about this character is that you pretty much can't believe anything he says after a while. And that becomes really exciting for me as an actor as well, because I say, if I say something to the audience, this is what happened, or this is what happened, or this is what's going to happen, I'm potentially lying to them.
Are you playing us just as you are playing these characters in the play?
Yeah.
You're pulling one over on us, too?
That's the exciting part. I think
to the people that you are giving the aside to, which in the history of the theater is usually the pillar of truth when you're doing an aside.
Yeah.
The aside could be a lie.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, the best part about this character is he lies to everyone, I think including himself. a lot of his reasoning behind his jealousy is clearly totally made up, and he's not a stupid guy. So the fact that he is using... these reasons. He's even, there's moments in the show where he is creating things and telling people, telling people stories that are not true. And he'll turn to the audience and say, okay, so that Cassio loves her. I do well believe it. He's actually saying, like, I know that it's not true, but I'm saying that in order for this lie to work, I'm going to have to even lie to myself. I'm going to have to make this a universal lie, and in through that he's sort of creating his own truths more than lies.
I am sure that psychologists have to have studied him.
Absolutely. I mean, we're, you know, I don't know if you've watched The Jinx at all, if you've watched this.
The Jinx?
Yes, on HBO, this Robert Durst, the story
of... I don't get around to a lot of television.
It's a documentary series, and it's a really great series, but the really interesting thing about it is there was an article in the New York Times really recently about the tie-in between this real-life person and Shakespeare, a couple of Shakespeare's villains, and specifically Iago, and his sociopathicness.
Mm.
It's really, really interesting. So there's some really, you know, we talk about jealousy and we talk about love, and these are these huge themes in this piece. But the other thing, like you said, the thing that is sort of reverberates are these characters, these people that are really, really innately evil that exist and that are around us, and that
and what's scary is apparently looking at Shakespeare's work, they were around back then.
Yeah, and even before.
Yeah,
and even before. So, yeah, you just kind of gotta. For me, I just have to embrace him.
How do you think Shakespeare's doing today in America?
I mean, I don't think he's well. He's been dead for a minute. I mean,
philosophically.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see. Yeah, I mean. A little green around the edges, probably. I don't know. I think that, for me, I mean, he's doing great. I've really found, really recently, a new sort of rekindled excitement and love for this author, this text.
There are a few things as timeless as Shakespeare.
Very few. Very few. You know, it's funny, we were talking today, again, Tegel and I, we were talking about Shakespeare and the fact that, you know, he didn't invent love, he didn't invent jealousy, he didn't invent any of these things. He just really found a way to say it in a way that nobody had ever said it before, and in a way that felt truthful. I remember, I'm quoting Ted now, but he said, in a way that almost makes you feel like, how did he know? That's how I felt about that. How did he know before I was even here that that's the way that I was going to feel? So that when I heard that, I went, I get it. That's exactly what it is. So that's, I think, where his joy really lands. You know, the crappy part is that I think that, and I think that Mark Rylance was quoted as saying this at some point, and was, I think, quoted out of context, but, you know, the way that Shakespeare is taught in our schools, in the school system, you know, because we could go on and on about the public school system in the United States, but the way that he's taught in the school system, I think, is the reason why it's broken. Because if it's taught properly, it is amazing. It's exciting. It's provocative. There's way more sex and rock and roll in Shakespeare than there is on TV these days. So if you really get down to it, you can really pull young people into this text. I don't have the answers, but if there was a way to make a younger audience and especially kids get excited about Shakespeare, I think that it would be a really good thing, because at its heart it is such an amazing thing. It's, you know, I was talking to my aunt the other day. They're coming in to see the show with my mother and father, and she said, how do you memorize all those lines? No, but she said, how do you work on memorizing these lines that are tantamount to a different language? And I said, well, they're not a different language. The syntax is different than we're used to, but really he's given you tools within the way that he's written these plays that there are few playwrights since him have been able to do. The way that he, you know, he'll give you a word and the meaning of the word is really important. The choice of that word is really important. But not just the meaning, also the sound of the word will inform.
Next to other words that he's put together.
Exactly. And it informs the actual emotion that he's given you this kind of stage direction through his writing. He's saying, this is what you're feeling in this moment and this is why you're feeling it. And I'm giving you this word because when you say this word, it makes your face literally literally do this. You know, you get into ease and you get into these things and it makes you smile. And he's telling you, I want you to look like this when you say this. I want you to feel this when you say this. So I'm not only giving you this word because it inspires a feeling. I'm giving you this word because it physically makes you do something that will tell the audience, I'm happy, I'm creepy, I'm this, you know, whatever it is. It's amazing.
I've always felt that he was a master at blending art, literature, and chemistry to a certain degree.
For sure. He's an alchemist of
words.
Absolutely.
And such a manipulator, using all three of those genres to get people to feel what he wanted them to feel.
Oh, absolutely.
It's a rich language. It's a poetry. It's almost like a code in a way.
It really is. But it's not a hard code. It's more like music. I look at it because the way that he wrote, you get your pitch through the vowels, through where he's giving you the vowels that he's giving you.
Right, right.
You get your length of note, for example, through the vowels as well, and through the use of consonants. And then you get your speed at which through the syllables, really. Mm-hmm. You know, the way that he'll use either monosyllabic words or bisyllabic words. He gives you. He's written music, so it's a code as if you looked at if you'd never seen music before in your life written out on a page. And even people that have never read music in their lives, they can look at a piece of music and go, okay, well that note is here, and that note is here, so that one is lower and that one is higher.
Mm.
That just pitch. And so once you break the code, once you know how to read Shakespeare's music, it all of a sudden becomes it totally makes sense. You just go, oh, that's it. I totally
he was directing as he was writing, in a sense.
Directing,
too.
Yes, choreographing. He was doing it all through the writing. It's really amazing. It's really amazing.
Now, with your ties to Canada, do you feel there is a different appreciation for Shakespeare, or let's even just say performing arts in general, in Canada as
versus
opposed
here?
To America?
I think we're it's hard because in Canada we have this real identity problem because of you guys, because of the States. We really will go like, yeah, but we're another country. Like we're North America and we speak English and it's our first language, but we are different. So they created this thing called the CRTC, which sort of makes sure that Canadian content radio stations play a certain amount of Canadian content and televisions play a certain amount of Canadian content. To me it's less even the States and Canada. It's like sort of a global issue that there's definitely a certain amount of people that see Shakespeare and classic works with a real reverence, sort of beyond what I think it should be.
Mm.
And then there's certain people that just go, oh, I don't want to have anything to do. It's too hard. It's like going to school. Like, I don't want
to. Which links back to being taught wrong in the first place.
Exactly. So I think that there's definitely a middle ground. But there's great places. In Canada, we have really, really amazing places. The Stratford Festival.
The Shaw Festival.
The Shaw
have you ever
Festival.
Been? Oh, incredible.
Yes. Yeah, there's really great places all over North America to do this kind of work. Now, being in the middle of doing Shakespeare, it definitely creates an excitement for me about the canon and about all of the possibilities that there are as far as making this. See, I'm watching kids watching all these high school students go to different shows right now, and it's it makes me really excited to be able to go to think about maybe a young kid is going to come and see this that is forced to by a girlfriend or has to because of high school. I'm gonna fail English if I don't go to see this thing. So I'm gonna go. And by the way that we present this, that he's gonna get turned on or she's gonna get turned on by Shakespeare, and that's amazingly exciting to me. Those are the moments to me because, even being in theater, I was one of those kids in high school that went, like, I don't get it. It's like if your parents are like huge Beatles fans and you're like, yeah, Beatles, whatever, Pearl Jam, they're cool, Beatles. And then you turn, you get into your 30s and 40s and you go, oh, they were right.
Mm-hmm.
They were totally right. So so I've sort of hit that moment in my life where I go, I get it. And I do wish, heaven forbid, that we ever are that we ever regret anything, but I'm really excited to have this sort of, for me, a renaissance into classic theater, and to get to do it here in this theater, which is frankly one of the more beautiful theaters that I've ever seen, just as far as, you know, what it looks like and how it sounds and how it plays and the way that you feel in this theater. It's really incredible. And I'm not blowing smoke because I want to come back, Marjorie. No, trust me. I really am excited about getting to play in this space. So,
well, thank you, sir, for being an agent for all that is good and true and wonderful about Shakespeare and
but
the theater. Have
I been telling the truth, though, this whole time? See, that's the thing. How much is seeping in?
Mm-hmm. We'll have to judge for ourselves. But here's to your performance as Iago.
In closing, we would like to once again thank our spectacular sponsors and strategic partners, Off the Wall Theater, Cefalo's Banquet and Events Center, Carnegie, Pennsylvania, Arcade Comedy Theater, Downtown, and Bergvavant is a proud supporter of Firefly Arts, creating opportunities and support for families living with autism through innovative arts programming. Find out more and show your support at fireflyarts.org. And be sure to follow Pittsburgh's Cultural Talk magazine online. You can find Bergvavant, the It in Pittsburgh, on Facebook, Twitter, or subscribe for free at www.bergvavant.com. This is Brian Edwards saying cheers and good night.